When you experience samadhi without a seed, the concentration is now so great that the awareness flows so completely into that object that there is no time to fixate any little part of that object as something rigid, opaque, extended in time and space. To use the language of modern physics, the object ceases to be particulate. It becomes a waveform. That waveform fills your consciousness. You stand in that waveform, and you are that wave. However, waves automatically interact. Particles bounce off of each other automatically. Two ice cubes bounce off each other. Two rivers will automatically flow together. So when you become the wave that is the flower, the wave that is your lover, the wave that is the taste of your food, that wave links to all the other waves in the universe, all the other so-called objects, all the other so-called beings. In a way that I will describe eventually, it also links to the source of all of these things. Within that, the characteristic of that level of merging is that it is both incredibly rich in that it contains the totality of the universe, and it is completely and refreshingly vacuous in that it is just a wave. It's not a thing. It is a doing. The somethingness in the experience is gone. Now, I know this sounds very mystical, schmystical, very weird, very hard to understand, perhaps. However, as your experience grows, you come to actually experience it yourself, and then it starts to make sense. It seems paradoxical, but so does modern physics. How can light be both a particle and a wave? How can something as obviously particulate as an electron be focused through an electron microscope as though it were just an energy wave? It's completely paradoxical. From the viewpoint of older physics, it makes no sense whatsoever. However, it is true. Even something like a bowling ball, which is about as particulate as you can imagine, has associated with it a de Broglie wave. Stephen Hawking, who is famous for his book A Brief History of Time, is presently working as his major focus on the equation for the wave of the entire universe. Universe as wave. So even though it may seem strange, it remarkably parallels the equally strange language of modern physics, which is quite the standard model and accepted by scientists all over the world. At the really deep level of concentration, there is not only a merging with the individual object, but a merging with the fundamental forces of the entire universe, the fundamental waveform. It's at that point that a person can be said to have complete experience. It's at that point that one has passed beyond mere concentration into the world of enlightenment, because now one understands things in a very, very different way. This is how the continuum of states is described in the Yoga Sutras. When you get into Buddhism, there are numerous works that describe in even more detail this process, dividing it actually into 9 stages, referred to by a generic term, samadhi. Also, the word dhyana comes into play there. And if you read the standard Buddhist works, you can see the detailed description where they distinguish these different stages. My point here is not to get into those details so much, but to merely sensitize you to the rather extraordinary fact that individuals living in different times, in different places, having totally different views of the world and religious beliefs, all describe a basically similar sequence of stages. And of course, most of these people didn't know about each other. Isaac Luria the Jewish Kabbalist living in the 16th century in Palestine never heard of St. Teresa of Avila, and St. Teresa of Avila certainly never heard of the Buddha. None of these people ever heard of Lao Tzu, okay? And yet, we can find a remarkable similarity in what they describe. In fact, we find two characteristics. A remarkable similarity in their descriptions, on one hand. The fact that their descriptions are extremely strange to the average person. And they're strange in the same way. When you get people that have had no contact with each other, that have radically different views of the world, talk about something with tremendous passion that is very different from the way the great majority of people look at things, and they more or less line up, then we have to take notice. We have to say, wait a minute, there's something really universal going on here, something really fundamental, significant, and human going on here. That's why the English writer Huxley, in search for a term to describe this universal mystical tradition, called it the perennial philosophy. Perennial means something that is constantly coming back, constantly popping up. This spirituality of high concentration, which then leads to something beyond the concentrated mind, constantly popping up in different ages, within different traditions, within different cultures. And not only does it come up within the major organized religions of the world, but it also comes up outside of the context of organized religion. It comes up within the secular context. There are secular enlightenments that happen to people. It doesn't necessarily have to be within a spiritual paradigm, but it's enlightenment nonetheless. Every once in a while, there are individuals who, perhaps through a performing art, like playing the piano, or dancing, or one of the martial arts, spontaneously enter states of very high concentration as they do that activity. Then, over the months and years, that state of high concentration during that activity deepens, goes through all the stages that I've described. And it also broadens, so that they find themselves, even outside of that activity, going into those states. Maybe they first experienced playing the piano, then notice that they would go into that state in other activities in daily life. Sports is another area where sometimes people fall into these states spontaneously, and then it may deepen and broaden enough so that we could really call it a legitimate meditation, even though they might not use the word meditation. Among those people that may develop high concentration through a particular secular activity, some of them occasionally go beyond the state of concentration. They don't just get completely focused when they dance, they become the dance. A person that has mastered all of the technical and feeling aspects of an art, a person that plays music, their technique is well developed and they have a lot of musicality, a lot of feeling with what they do, is a great artist. Is there an expression of art beyond that? Yes, there's an expression of art beyond that. Perhaps they enter into a state of high concentration when they do it. People that watch them are pulled into a state like that. Then that's one step beyond mastering your art. But there's one step beyond that still. It happens very seldom, but it does happen. The person in performing their art may enter into samadhi without a seed while they perform their art. At that point, they are no longer performing. The universe is manifesting through their art. And I do not mean that poetically. I do not mean that metaphorically. I mean that literally. here we have the path of concentration and the path of going beyond concentration, the mystical path, enlightenment, in a completely secular context. I think it's an absolutely remarkable fact that there is so much similarity around the world. And as I say, it was one of the great eye-opening and mind-broadening experiences of my life to realize this. When we practice meditation, we may practice within a certain tradition. We are linked to a global phenomenon that has been at the core of human experience all over this planet for a long time. In point of fact, it is probably the case that our very ancient ancestors, before the arising of civilization, when we were still in a tribal state, lived an awful lot of their life in a meditative state just naturally. And then with the arising of civilization, that becomes lost, and it's necessary to create conceptual frameworks and specific practice techniques to get back there. So we are linked with something very, very large when we practice meditation. And I think that's just a very wonderful and beautiful thing. So far, we've discussed pretty thoroughly the aspect of concentration, its different facets, the common misconceptions that people have about it, its role in world culture, world mystical traditions. Now, we're going to speak practically about how to develop it and apply it, and ultimately how to go beyond it to enlightenment itself. Commonly, when one begins this practice, one chooses some object of focus. One could refer to it as the object of meditation or the object of concentration. And there are a lot of possibilities. One common thing that is chosen is the body sensation associated with the breathing process. Even within that, there are any number of ways of focusing on the breathing process. Another common initial object in meditation is a mantra, a sound or a sequence of sounds that one either repeats out loud or repeats to oneself silently. The mind wanders, one gently comes back to it. It is, of course, possible to have larger objects of initial focus. For example, one could take any and all body sensations. Or one could take some activity, like the simple work activity, cleaning the house. The mind wanders, one gently returns. That could be one's initial object of focus. Frequently, though, one takes something small and manageable. One possible initial object of concentration is the pleasant sensations associated with the state of sitting in a relaxed way. Now, one advantage of using the pleasant sensations of relaxation as the initial object of focus is that one gets a positive feedback. The more one focuses on that pleasure, the more pronounced that pleasure becomes, so there's a kind of motivation to develop greater and greater concentration. In this approach to meditation, which I call global relaxation, one sits down and feels the body settle into a posture wherein you can maintain alertness but also a relaxed quality. You could do it sitting in a chair. You could do it sitting on the floor. After you have gotten a general sense of being settled in the posture, you drop your jaw just slightly, and that will produce a little bit of relaxation in the jaw, and you may be able to detect that spreading from your jaw through your face or perhaps your face and head. It's quite subtle, but most people can detect that, and they can also maintain a contact with that. Then you notice that when you breathe in, your chest tends to rise up, and on the out-breath, the settling of the chest has associated with it a pleasant sensation, which can spread from the chest into the abdomen and the whole front of the torso and around the sides. Likewise, you notice that when you breathe in, your shoulders tend to rise up, perhaps just slightly, and on the out-breath they drop just a little bit. That produces a quality of relaxation in the shoulders, which you can then feel spreading down your arms into your hands, and you can maintain contact with that quality. It doesn't just go away right away. It sort of stays around. Likewise, on an in-breath, the spine tends to stretch upwards. And on the out-breath, the vertebrae settle. That produces a subtle quality of relaxation that you can feel spreading over the spine and spreading from there over the whole back area. When you're in a sitting position, your legs don't have to work to carry you. So they're limp and they're restful. And there's a very, very subtle quality of pleasure or restfulness associated with that fact, which you can attempt to contact. Now, the quality of relaxation in the body is intrinsically pleasant. However, initially, for most people, it's very subtle. That pleasure is very subtle. But by time after time, dropping the jaw and really feeling that and feeling that relaxation spread and going through the body in this way, you eventually develop a real tangible contact with this subtle physical pleasure of repose. You're able to maintain that contact over much or perhaps the whole body simultaneously. Of course, because the sensation is subtle, other events can intrude. For example, your thoughts can arise and pull you away. Sights and sounds from the outside world could arise and pull you away. And most particularly, other kinds of body sensations can arise, including unpleasant ones. Your legs start to hurt, your back gets tired, etc. You get uncomfortable sensations arising that are much stronger than that subtle relaxation quality. There's nothing we can do to stop that. Actually, that's perfectly okay. So it's very important not to begrudge the fact that these types of things are arising. Basically, what is going to arise other than that subtle relaxation quality is inwards pulled towards planning, judging, fantasizing, remembering, internal conversations, internal images, the thinking process. Outwardly pulled to sights and sounds and a sense that there's a scene around you. And then other kinds of sensations, usually mostly physical, although there could be emotionally charged sensations also arising if you're going through any sort of emotional thing. When these stronger phenomena, and they could be 10 times, even 100 times stronger than that subtle relaxation quality, when these other phenomena arise, the trick is to not begrudge that fact, but to the best of your ability, ignore them. Usually they're unpleasant anyway, so ignore them and come back to feeling that global subtle relaxation pleasure. To the best of your ability, why do this? What is the advantage of this? What is the payoff? Well, by feeling it over as much of your body as possible, of course you're having to work to develop concentration. That takes effort. Your basic concentration power is being strengthened by that effort to maintain global contact with the subtle relaxation pleasure. Likewise, when you get distracted, you'll come back to it. That pulling back to something subtle, despite the arising of gross distractions, also develops your concentration power. However, because the thing that you come back to is intrinsically pleasant, that gives you a little bit of a reward to recompense you for the effort required in letting go of those distractions and pulling back and keeping that broad contact. That is part of what makes this technique helpful. And as I say, at first it may be extremely subtle and you may not be able to feel it over your whole body. But as you do it over and over again, the physical pleasure of the relaxation becomes stronger and stronger. So it's easier to maintain contact with it. It's easier to let go of distractions. A sort of positive feedback loop is developed. One might say that how does this differ from just a progressive relaxation exercise or something like that? It differs in several respects. First of all, there is a certain aspect of effort required, not only the effort of the focus, but also if that quality of relaxation goes away, you have to reestablish it. Once again, feel the jaw drop, go through the body, the different contact, or induce those qualities. There's this aspect of continuous working at it. It's not a sort of spacing out kind of thing. There's a little bit more to it. Whenever your body is globally relaxed, by definition, you are in a state that in the Buddhist tradition is called equanimity. Equanimity is a state of non-interference with the natural flow of the senses. There's two aspects to equanimity. One is, we might call equanimity of the mind, when we're not judging. And the other is equanimity of the body, when the whole body is relaxed, despite what may be erupting within it or outside or in the thoughts. Now, it turns out that whenever we maintain a state of equanimity, although we may not be aware of it, consciousness is being purified. Fundamental changes are taking place deep within the subconscious. When one is sitting and maintaining this sort of global relaxation, which brings a global openness to the body, despite the fact that all sorts of stuff that seems to be distractions is arising, what is actually happening is that one is greeting all of these eruptions with equanimity. Particularly when pain and discomfort arise. I know it's very difficult to maintain a sense of relaxation when you've got a pain that's 100 times more intense in one part of your body. To feel your whole body relaxed while that's happening is extremely difficult. On the other hand, if you are able to do so, deep within the subconscious, your fundamental relationship to that pain is being rewired. Something is changing. And as I say, as you sit there, you may not be aware of that at all. You notice that afterwards, your perception and behavior in day-to-day life is changing in a positive direction, and the changes seem spontaneous, effortless, and permanent. So what have you been doing? You weren't consciously aware of making any decisions or trying to be a different person. As you were sitting there and greeting whatever arose in the perceptual field with this state of global relaxation, deep down, that created an ambiance or environment within which the deep mind could rewire itself. So that's why it's more than just a relaxation exercise. There are some further subtleties about this. In addition to seeing it as an equanimity process, which therefore is purifying and reprogramming the deep mind, another reason that this technique causes growth is that if the relaxation pleasure becomes very clear to you, you can begin to ask yourself, is this pleasure completely still and stable, or does it change moment by moment? Now, any body sensation can change in a variety of ways. Since it is a body sensation, it has a shape to it, and therefore the shape can change. It has location, the location can shift. It has intensity, the intensity can shift, get stronger, get weaker. And it has quality, and the qualities can shift. As you're sitting there and feeling the pleasure, either both kinds of pleasure or just one, you may become aware that it is wave-like. The borders of your body may undulate, they may vibrate. The pleasure may become like a jellyfish, sort of expanding here, contracting there. It may flow like honey. There may be flow patterns associated with this pleasure when you attend to it very closely. Or it may be absolutely still and stable without any change in intensity, shape, just the same throughout the whole body. There's only those two possibilities. If it's absolutely still and stable, great. You can focus in on that stillness and stability of it, and that will inform your entire being and bring your whole mind and body into deeper and deeper states of peacefulness and stability. So that's fine. On the other hand, if there's change and movement, you can focus in on the change and movement and start to sort of give yourself to the rhythms of it. And the pleasure will start to feel like it's massaging you. Like nature is massaging you. You're not meditating, you're being meditated. You're flowing with these natural waveforms. And they become very rhythmic, very periodical, very predictable, and therefore writable. That takes you deeper and deeper, but also involves another aspect, because you're starting to see the impermanent nature, which is to say the essential wave nature of that pleasure. And of course, that can be generalized to an understanding that the same nature is true for any body sensation, pleasant or unpleasant. They tend to go in waves that expand, contract, undulate, and vibrate. And that can be extended to include not only any and all body sensation, but any of the six senses or combination of the six senses, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, the feeling body, and even the thinking mind, have as their nature that they are actually waveforms. They are impermanent. They are activities. And that is one of the most important insights that a person can get. That insight comes through concentration, but when that insight becomes very clear, a new state of consciousness arises that goes beyond concentration, because one has had insight into the fundamental nature of experience, which is that experience is an interactive wave that contains the entire universe. And that's when you go beyond merely states of bliss, relaxation, concentration, to states of enlightenment, to states of insight, which aren't states. They are the nature of things, so they don't come and go. They give you a happiness independent of conditions. By attending to any qualities of impermanence that may be evident in that pleasure, you are beginning the process of contacting the nature of nature. Now, you may ask, why start with this as opposed to focusing on the breath or focusing on a mantra? Actually, there's no compelling reason to start with this. One's initial object of meditation can be whatever one feels most comfortable with. The reason that I offer this as a way to start is that it is intrinsically pleasant and most people can do it. Therefore, it gives a reward fairly immediately. And in this culture, people are into immediate gratification. So it's a technique suited to this culture. However, it is set up in such a way that it is not a cul-de-sac. It is not a blind alley that just leads to feeling good and doesn't take you any further. It's set up in a way to guarantee the development of high concentration, to bring purification of the deep mind through maintaining the relaxation through more and more eruptions of stuff and not begrudging those eruptions. And it's also set up to give you insight into the impermanence or the wave nature, starting with the wave nature of your relaxation pleasure. So all of those are things that go beyond just a simple feel-good kind of relaxation exercise. Now, this claim that the nature of body sensation and broadly the nature of all six senses, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, the feeling body, and the thinking mind, is wave-like, is quite a claim. It doesn't seem to correspond to our usual experience. Our sense of self seems quite solid and separate. Our sense of surrounding space seems quite rigid. And within that rigid space, it certainly seems that hard material objects are embedded. What is this claim that all of this has as its nature, wave or vibration? And how can this claim be justified? Well, the metaphor that I like to use is drawn from the history of science. If I were to claim that my body is made up of billions of tiny little building blocks called cells, and that the body of my cat is made out of more or less similar building blocks, and that the trees and plants are made of building blocks roughly similar, and that there are invisible little creatures, trillions and trillions of them on the surface of my clothes, everywhere, that consists of only those building blocks, and that some of them can cause significant diseases. If I were to claim this, everybody would agree with this. If I were to claim it in this century. But what if I were to claim it 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago? There is no reason why people would buy it. In fact, people would probably think it was ridiculous, or worse than ridiculous, downright dangerous idea. Totally counterintuitive in the sense of going against all of our natural sense of things. Unnatural, counterintuitive, challenging to the way that the ordinary person views the world and the way that the world ought to be, according to the ordinary view. Yet we all know that, in fact, it is quite true. It's called the cell theory of life and the germ theory of disease. It's not all disease is germ-based, but a lot is. Why is it that we all accept this claim, since our senses don't tell us this? Our senses tell us that a cat is a very different critter from a human being, and we don't see any underlying common thread. And a plant is a very different critter from a cat. Our senses don't really give us an immediate perception that there's an underlying common structure there. The only reason that we accept this is that about 500 years ago, people developed a special awareness-extending tool called the optical microscope. And this special awareness extending tool can magnify and resolve. That is to say, it can take a physical object, make it look bigger, and also help you make distinctions. Parts of the object that would, with the naked eye, tend to fall together, when looked at under the microscope, those parts can be separated. And this ability to magnify and separate allowed people to actually see the cells distinctly, to see the subtle underlying common structure that unifies all of life. Because they could see it directly, they could describe it, they could formulate it, and anybody could look through the microscope and agree. The microscope does nothing but magnify and resolve. It gives you a bigger view, and it allows you to separate out components. But as the result of that awareness extending tool, our entire concept of what we are and what life is has changed. And the history of science is marked by a sequence of awareness extending tools, each one of which looks at finer and finer levels of structure of the external world, and each one of which gives us a shockingly new paradigm of what the material world is, shocking to our ordinary sense of things, and also a powerful paradigm, a useful paradigm, a useful new view of things. So with the electron microscope, we can see down into the molecules. With X-ray diffraction, we can see down into the atoms. With particle accelerators, we can see into the nucleus, looking at finer and finer structures. Then we get a picture of the world very different from our usual concept. Modern physics sounds like mysticism. It may not be a coincidence, because there's a fundamental similarity between certain aspects of the mystical path and what the physicist and scientist does. Those aspects of the mystical path that involve what is called mindfulness use the high concentration that I have described in such detail as an internal microscope. And just as there are different magnifications on the microscope, and then beyond the microscope there are other awareness extending tools that allow you to see finer and finer structures of the outside world, so that sequence of stages of concentration that I described, from light focus to full-blown trance, can be looked upon as representing higher and higher magnification and resolution power for investigating what? The external material world? No. For investigating the internal subjective world of our six senses, in particular, our thoughts and feelings, the ideas in the mind and the sensations in the body that give us a sense of self, for one thing, can be investigated with this kind of microscopic attention. And not surprisingly, when they are so investigated, the paradigm, the model that we come up with, it's completely against the normal description of things. As we look more and more carefully at ordinary experience, we come to see that what is characteristic of experience at every level is change and movement. At a very highly concentrated level, what appears to the naked eye as the solid body at a level of high magnification appears not as the solid body but as cells. In the same way, what appears to us as our senses at a very high level of focus, it presents itself in terms of its fundamental building blocks, which are expanding and contracting vibrations. Very similar to some of the theories in physics where they say the fundamental building blocks of the universe are something called vibrating strings. Vibrate at different frequencies, and the different frequencies correspond to the material world as we know it. Remarkably similar. When we look internally, subjectively, we find that there is a common thread that runs through all of our senses. And it is this vibratory quality that unifies mind and body, because the thinking mind is made out of vibrations, waves. The feeling body is made out of vibrations. And there's no real distinction between the waves. They automatically sum together and merge as a single mind-body wave, called an integrated human personality. We find that our hearing and seeing consists of the same vibrations. So there's no fundamental distinction between so-called external objects that we hear and see and our internal thoughts and feelings. They become a single unified envelope of vibration. Just as when we understood that cells are in plants and cells are in animals, suddenly this fundamental distinction between the two forms of life on this planet goes away. It's all life. That was extremely shocking to people. The first shock was that the animals have the same structure as humans. Some people thought that was the end of Christianity right there. That fundamental distinction between human and animal, supposedly humans had divine eternal souls and animals didn't have it. But we start to see, wait, there's an underlying commonality between animal and human that was very uncomfortable for people initially. Now it's just accepted. It's taught everyone. The idea that inside and outside are not fundamentally separate, this is quite a revolutionary idea. We can experience it directly when we experience the common denominator. If you only see cells, you only see life. If you experience the fine level of your senses only, then you only have a sense of the oneness of all things. You just experience existence, being. There's no fundamental distinction between the vibrations that constitute your experience and the vibrations that constitute another person's experience. You realize that you live in others, in some sense, just as really as you live within your own thoughts and feelings. That gives a fundamental change in your relationship to other beings, particularly other human beings. We have that word empathy, to feel what another feels. Well, this is real empathy. At an even deeper level, one realizes that the reason for this vibratory, undulatory nature of experience is that experience is responding constantly at many, many scales of time and space simultaneously to the two fundamental forces of nature, which might be called yin and yang or contraction and expansion. Many words could be used, affirmation, negation, life and death. Within those waveforms, one comes into direct contact with the forces that mold all things, that shape the coasts of continents and mold the outline of a human face that expands as a globe and contracts within the eyes, expands out as an ear flap, okay, and expands as a nose and contracts as a nostril. The fundamental molding forces of the universe are experienced directly when one gets down to the wave vibratory level of the deep structure of our ordinary senses. At that level, one eventually realizes that the sense of observing those forces, the sense of I'm meditating in contact with this, the sense of I as a meditator, I as a doer, I as experiencer, really consists of subtle ideas and body sensations, and those subtle ideas and body sensations are the same waves that you're observing, and they are formed by the same fundamental forces of nature. So the sense of the separate self disappears for a period of time. It comes back, but it disappears for a period of time and is replaced by a figure ground reversal. When one first starts, one feels that one is meditating on the fundamental forces of nature, in contact with the fundamental forces of nature. And that's wonderful. One is in contact with these waveforms. At some point, one becomes those waveforms. One becomes those fundamental forces. And one, for a period of time, unbecomes the product of those fundamental forces. And what is the product of those fundamental forces? Time, space, self, and objects. All objects. These are the products of those forces. And one unbecomes the thoughts and feelings that produce the sense of self, and one abides participating in the activity that generates all things. And so one's identity has now become the wave and the forces that underlie the wave. For a period of time. Could be 5 minutes, could be 5 hours. But each time one does this, one's sense of who one is changes. So that eventually, a change in one's understanding, a fundamental paradigm shift, comes over one. And one realizes that, yes, a lot of the time I am these thoughts and feelings, but that's just because I'm not paying close enough attention. Whenever I have the limited identity of my thoughts and feelings, which is maybe most of the time, even for a very enlightened person, maybe most of the time, so then what's the difference between a very enlightened person and any other person? The difference is they know. Whenever my identity is limited to these thoughts and feelings, they know why it's happening. I'm not paying close enough attention. I'm now caught in this illusion, but they know it's an illusion. And they also know how, at will, to let go of that limited identity and unbecome their thoughts and feelings and re-become the source of their thoughts and feelings, which is also the source of time, space, and objects. You become your parents, just like when you grow up physically, first you're a child, then you mature to the point where you internalize the adult and you become the parent. So in the same way spiritually, first you're the product of the forces of the universe. Then you grow up until you start to internalize those forces and in some way participate in them and truly become them. To the extent to which one realizes that one is those forces, that one is the source, to that extent one is quite immortal. The fundamental forces of affirmation and negation, life and death, expansion and contraction, will never pass away, although one's individual mind and body do. So when the claim was made that the meditative path could bring a person to a state of unconditional happiness, it was made based on this. You could be dying in pain. It seems like the worst condition that any human being could be in. You're in pain. Your faculties are being stripped from you. There's nothing but confusion, fear, and pain. And all you have to look forward to is death. It's a horrible condition to imagine. However, it is a condition. Either as the result of having cultivated meditation, or if you're fortunate, perhaps nature will just take you there spontaneously. you can begin to have a complete experience of dying. The pain may become so great that it puts you automatically in a state of concentration. So great that it forces you into a state of equanimity. That's what nature always intends anyway. But not all human beings are able to experience it that way. If, however, you have done meditation, very high probability that that would happen. In any event, under those conditions, either through practice or, if you're fortunate, through nature, you will come to experience the wave-like qualities of your pain, the wave and vibratory qualities of your fear, and even your confusion. You will become the waves and unbecome the pain and confusion, and then eventually you will become the fundamental forces of nature that are expanding and contracting, the dialectic of push and pull, of affirmation and negation that form those waves. You will become that. And to the extent that you are that, you're not suffering, and you're not going to die. You can never die. As long as there is the rhythm of the seasons, as long as stars expand and contract, as long as atoms vibrate, as long as superstrings resonate, you'll be in those vibrations. You'll be in those rhythms. You'll be in that flow. You are that. It never dies. Can't die. It is life and death itself. So to that extent, your existence is quite immortal. So even the experience of dying in pain, the worst possible condition that we can imagine, there can be a kind of deep happiness that is quite independent of that circumstance. This is what the endeavor of meditation is all about, because if you know you can die that way, then imagine the kind of empowerment that that brings when we have to face this or that situation in day-to-day life. You will probably be able to remember experiences that relate to meditation, even though you may not have thought of it in those terms. A lot of people think about meditation, certain stereotypes of what meditation is. But the way I like to explain it to people is to ask them to look back on their own daily life. Even if they've never done a specific practice, if you look back on some activity that you do in life that's meaningful to you, you'll remember that sometimes you've been very focused and present during that activity, whereas other times you can probably remember being rather scattered and having it difficult to be fully present with that activity. And you probably also remember that the times when you were more focused, more present with that activity was, on one hand, much more fulfilling, and on the other hand, probably more effective in terms of its results. Everybody is aware of these fluctuations in our degree of presentness or focus in daily life. In fact, if you reflect back on your life, you may remember a few very significant times when you became extremely highly focused. Often that takes place under one of two circumstances, either circumstances that are extremely relaxed, perhaps you're walking in the forest alone, or during or after a particularly significant experience of making love, you enter a state of extreme presence and deep quiet. The other circumstance under which this extreme experience of presence can occur is at the exact opposite end of the spectrum, under dangerous situations, perhaps life-threatening. You're about to have a car accident. You think you're going to drown. You are accosted in some way physically. And you find that time slows down. Your mind becomes very peaceful. You are extremely present and focused in what is going on, and able to deal with it both subjectively and objectively more effectively. So just about everyone has experiences of fluctuations in their day-to-day levels of presence or focus in ordinary activities. And an awful lot of people, at least on occasion, have had experiences of extraordinary states of presence and focus. And as I say, when we look back, it is certainly the case that both subjectively and objectively, things are better when we're in that state of presence and focus. What few people realize is that that condition of presence and focus is trainable, that it doesn't have to be at the whims of day-to-day fluctuations. It doesn't have to wait for extreme or unusual conditions. A person's baseline of presence and focus can be elevated through systematic practice. And therefore, both in terms of one's subjective world and in terms of one's objective performance, one's entire scale at which one lives life can be across the board elevated. This is probably one of the most significant discoveries that the human species has made. The discovery that focus and presence can be cultivated. The metaphor that I like to use is that it's very much like exercising a muscle. If you think about the process of physical exercise, what do you do? You have to learn a certain procedure for doing the exercise. You have to be instructed in the Nautilus equipment or told how to use the free weights so that it's most effective and you don't damage yourself. You have to do the exercises on a regular basis. You have to be willing to put some energy into it. You have to continue doing it for a long period of time, make it part of your regimen of life. And as the result of that, the strength in your muscles is permanently elevated. Your muscles get stronger and stronger and stronger. Once that strengthening has taken place, you have those improved muscles available for many, many activities in daily life. In the same way, what we might refer to as concentration power can be strengthened. To do that, you do the same process. One needs instruction in certain procedures that strengthen the concentration power. One needs to do the procedures on a regular basis. One needs to keep it up for the long term. One needs to put a degree of energy into it, be willing to work a bit. As the result of that, one's concentration muscle becomes permanently strengthened. Just as once the physical muscle has been permanently strengthened, all of one's physical activities are improved. Once the concentration muscle has been permanently strengthened, all of one's activities, period, are improved. Every aspect of a person's life is impacted by this, because there is no aspect of human life that is not affected by our degree of presence and focus. We might say that this is the most fundamental of all skills that a person can develop. Any other skill that one might want to develop, any other activity that a person might want to do, will be impacted by one's base level of focus and concentration. People that have had the sporadic, extraordinary experiences of concentration will tell you that they were the most meaningful times of their life, that their whole life changed as the result of that.